good times. Bright lights and excitement. I wake up wearing last night's makeup. Lovers, which one never mattered till my dreams were scattered, till my world was shattered.
It's all right. Oh Lord, it's all right. It's all right. You're listening to WMFO 91.5 FM and WMFO.org. This is Mike Stewart, and this is a new show called Radio Bookmark. And if you could hold 1 second, I have to change my headphones. Hold on.
What happened there?
Okay, I'm good now. Okay, so thank you, Alex, for a great, great show. Thank you. Here every Thursday. You have to excuse me, catching my breath here. We're going to do 3 interviews tonight. This is called Radio Bookmark. This is the new show. My co-host is Mike Newman. I'm Mike Stewart. You've probably heard me before on Boston Women Rock, on The Town with Mikey D, and then Live Day. You'll have to excuse me. What we're going to do, we're going to do 3 interviews tonight. We're going to start with Don White. He is a local folk and comedian, folky, and he came out with a book. This is, I believe, his second book, called The Hitchhiking Years and 4 Other Stories. And we welcome Don White. Hi, Don.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Good, good. You'll have to excuse me. I'm adjusting my headphones here.
Sure.
My nose is running inside my mask. We are still under restrictions. We have to wear masks in the studio. How are you doing today, Don?
I'm well, thank you.
Well, thank you for coming on the show. As I said, this is your second book called The Hitchhiking Years, and it's out on Barry Park Press in Lynn, Mass., and people mm-hmm. can get it at www.white.net.
DonWhite.net,
excuse me. Would you consider this book, you would say it's more of a travel book of your trek across this country and different views and things you've come across, but would you say it's a love story also?
Of course, yeah. So just so people know, the book has 5 stories in it. Half the book is called Hitchhiking Years, and that's the story of the 3 years that my girlfriend then and wife now and I hitchhiked around North America. So we got hopelessly addicted to hitchhiking. We hitchhiked to Alaska when I was 17 and just kept going. Just got used to the freedom and the and trusting that people would be kind to us and all of it. And it was very addictive and a very deep sort of freedom. It's definitely a love story because we're still together.
That's great.
And Go ahead. I think I'm the only person that can make the statement. I left Lynn, Massachusetts with my girlfriend right out of high school and hitchhiked for 3 years, and I'm still together with her. That's got to be a very small group of people who could say that.
I think it's a really good story. I think for the times you're going through and a lot of the stress that people go, it's a good read. It gives you a little insight, because when you're out on the road, you're very dependent on each other and you're facing different things on a daily basis and making a lot of decisions, and the wheels can come flying off at any time. So I think it's a good book for the people now going through a lot of stuff.
Well, the two marks for it, the people that really have been have been buying it are people my age, or people who were hitchhikers in the 70s and in the 60s and remember it as a favorite part of their life. But there's also a lot of young people who are curious about what it was like to, for every place you went, for there to be hitchhikers and people living out of backpacks. It's a pretty good story. I'm pretty happy with it, and it reminded me, there's a lot of memories there. It shaped us. We were different after that. I have grandchildren and all that now. Yeah. And through the years, one of the things is that we never panicked, because we had those 3 years where we had to just wait until somebody was nice to us. Somebody had to, we had nobody to call, no cell phones, no nothing. Just had to be patient and not freak out and see what happens. And it always kind of worked out. And so as we were raising our kids and, coming across all the problems that comes with that and building a life and jobs and all that, we sort of retain that. You know, we wouldn't freak out at the beginning of a problem. You know, we were just kind of used to stepping back and taking a breath. And that's something that the road taught us that paid dividends over the decade, I would say.
Would you say, growing up in Lynn, the city you grew up in, I grew up in Malden, it made you kind of streetwise, and that way you could make really quick decisions whether you were going to take a ride or put yourself in a situation. Do you think that was a big plus for you and your soon-to-be wife later on?
I do think so. Like, people would say to us, are you crazy? You're going to just go hitchhike for years at a time? And I would just think to myself, I don't think that I'm going to come across things that are more intense than what I'm used to just growing up here. And that turned out to be true. I mean, there's some luck involved. You have to be lucky, too. But, you know, that's true no matter where you are. And you have to make some quick judgments. And growing up in this place where there's a lot of violence that we both did, you know, when we were young, saw a lot of violence and a lot of, you know, things that you had to think quick about. It did help. You know, I still think you have to be lucky a little bit, too. You know, like some of the things was we learned not to hitchhike at night and to get up in the morning early and to get people going to work and coming home from work, not coming out of a bar at 3 in the morning. You know, so some decisions like that made the odds better that we wouldn't be in too intense of a situation. But, yeah.
Do you think this had any effect on your music writing?
Gee, that's a good question, and I'm not sure. It may have, because it influenced everything about me. You know, I think about it. You know, 3 years of my life with my girlfriend, just living on the kindness of strangers. You know, if people weren't kind to us, we wouldn't have gotten anywhere, and somebody was always kind to us all the way to Newfoundland, all the way down the Alcan Highway, up and down the coast, everywhere we went. And so, yeah, I think it did influence all of my writing and my thinking, because it puts me in a headspace where I don't feel like the world is a terrible place. I always, you know, Mike, I always feel like the camera crew that leaves Boston to drive to Worcester to film the horrible thing that happened, I always think about all the houses that they passed where nothing horrible happened.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's 30,000 houses. And not only did something not happen there today that was bad in any of those 30,000 houses, but not last week, not for a year, maybe most of those houses, a terrible thing never happened in. And that's the way I see it. I think they have to pass millions of good people to show me the horrible person. That's what I think the math is. And I think it was born in the 70s when I was totally dependent on the kindness of strangers. And no matter where I was, it never let me down, ever.
So, in a way, instead of seeing the glass half full, you see the potential of the glass totally full.
I do. I'm not naive. Growing up in Lynn, I know that there's trouble. I just think that there's money in freaking me out. I think that that television and media, that clickbait and all that stuff, it's in their interest. There's a financial incentive for them to convince me that everything is awful. And I know there are terrible things and difficult things, but most people everywhere, Idaho, Massachusetts, California, anywhere in the world, most people do not want anything from a stranger. They tend to be kind, I think. So that's my theory, and I'm sticking with it.
There you go. When you were traveling, and I think I caught a little bit hint of it in the book, that there was probably areas that you really liked going to and visiting and exploring and meeting new friends and reconnecting with friends you've made. Want to highlight that a bit, and then we'll go to the other side, places you don't think was that great.
Well, in those days, which would have been, so we hitchhiked all of 1975, all most of 77, and all of 1979. So So it was basically the mid to late 70s. And in those days, the West Coast from, I would say, Santa Cruz all the way to Vancouver was the easiest. That's where the most young people were, the most colleges, the most what we would call freaks in those days. You know, that's where it wasn't, people weren't calling the cops because they saw you walking down the street with your backpack on.
Yeah.
So those, and then after that, every state sort of had a college town where, even if the state was, you know, the other way, you know, didn't like strangers and all that. If what you got to Ann Arbor, let's say, or in Colorado, Boulder, and those like that, those were like sanctuaries. So West Coast, the easiest, and college towns would be our destinations early on, you know, before we got accustomed to being in places where there was nobody like us, which we did later.
Now, to put to the other side, was there places that, in retrospect, or there was a little bit of foreboding going to that area, and you kind of found out, either or, when you got there, that was not a great experience for you?
Well, we stayed away from the South because, not from the people were sweet, but the law.
Yeah.
You know, the police, instead of them just escorting you off the highway, they would, you know, you would hear from other people that they'd bring you to jail.
Yeah.
So we never really went down there that much. But we did get used to going to places where there were no hippies and no colleges. And, Idaho, all the mountain states, Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona, and all that. And, it wasn't the same as being around San Francisco and Big Sur. There would be some hostility a little bit, but I'm still going to go back to, we learned that most people were okay. It helped that we were adorable, like we were just like really happy, and that the third year we had a golden retriever with us, like people would stop and just take pictures of us. So that, you know, I mean, we did run into some places where people wouldn't serve us in the diner, and you know, some hostility, the way that, you know, prejudice. It was prejudice, you know.
Yeah.
You know, they thought they knew who we were by the way we looked. But none of it was worse than what we experienced growing up in Lynn. So it wasn't that bad.
So you didn't experience the tail end of real hostile times down south where there was a lot of segregation and stuff still kind of going on. You didn't get to experience that. Okay.
No, we stayed away from there because other travelers would told us that they would put you in jail for hitchhiking down there. Where most of the places that we were in the West, in the Northwest, and then on the East Coast too, New England and up to, Canada and all that stuff, they would just tell you to stay off the highway, you know, go down to the ramp. Again, decisions, right? Like, you know, everything isn't rosy, but everything isn't horrible, and your decision-making is a big factor in what happens.
Yeah, you wrote another book before this.
Mm-hmm.
And can you give us a little overview of that other book and what that was about?
That book is called Memoirs of a C Student. It's probably 15 years old now. It's still around. You can still get it on my website. And that's 12 stories. This book is 5 stories, and that one is 12 stories. A lot of that book is about growing up in Lynn and my experience as a young person there and what it was like to be a kid down there and all kinds of things. And that book has done well for me. You know, I self-published both of my books, and, you know, I'm probably on my, 12th or 13th printing of that book. So that's pretty good for an independent person, yeah.
Where inside you or what timing hit you go, I have to write this? Is it because you're getting older, or you're thinking it about a lot, or your other contemporaries have done the same, you know, the musicians or people you know? Where does that come from, that I got to do this?
You know, that's a really good question, Mike. I appreciate that question. I'm serious. Like, you know, There's a bunch of reasons. First of all, my first inclination was to write prose. I only wrote songs. I have 10 albums. I don't know if your listeners know that, but I made my career as a singer-songwriter. I'm going to play at the Guthrie Center in 2 weeks for the 10th time, you know, where Alice's Restaurant was filmed and all that. So I have a nice little career as a songwriter. But my first love was prose, was writing stories. I wrote songs because I got so busy with kids and all that, that I could write them in the car. I didn't need to have an office, and, you know, I didn't have that kind of time it took to write prose. But it's always been my true love. And the reason is because songs are small. You have to squash your ideas into them, you know, where with a story you can digress and you can stretch out an idea, and I prefer that. So I'm inclined to do it if I have the time to do it. The other reason is financial. It's, you know, even if people love you now, it's hard for them to buy a CD from you because they don't have anything to play it on. There's not one in their car and all that. So people still buy books. And so the last show that I did, I don't know, I think I made $300 at my merch table. If I only had CDs, I would have made $20.
Yeah.
You know, people don't buy them, but they will buy books. And so there's a few reasons, but thanks for asking that question.
What's roughly, you think, your demographics of your followers? Is it from younger children up to people that are in their 90s? Is there a certain age bracket, or is it pretty wide for you?
Well, you know, the bulk of them are my age. I'm in my 60s, and so they, you know. But there is a pretty, what's happening now, and I remember this when I was a kid. Like, we were really into music, and when we realized that Sonny Terry and Bronnie McGee and Lightnin' Hopkins were still alive, we're like, we got to see these guys while they're still around. And now I'm seeing, like, hipsters and people that are really into music coming out to see me, and that's my feeling that I get. Like, we better see this guy before he dies. So, my show is it's at least half comedy. I used to be a stand-up comedian, and there's a lot of laughter in the show, so it draws a pretty wide range of people because everybody loves to laugh, you know?
If you were doing this trip today, would it be different with what's going on in the country? Would you be more hesitant? Would you think that your book would come out differently? How do you think what's going on today would affect that?
I think it's completely different, and I wouldn't recommend that anyone do it. Although I am online, you can find these kids who do hitchhike, and mostly they're in Alaska and Hawaii, and it's very different now. Like, they take a picture of the license plate, and they send it to the cloud, and people can watch. People can know who you're with. All, you know, technology has made it so different. But I don't recommend it to anybody because it's dangerous. I mean, we were lucky and good, and the times were different. When was the last time you saw a hitchhiker that didn't look like, you know, dangerous? You know, you don't see it. So I don't think it's. I think you use travel apps and you do it so your mom can sleep at night. You know, that's what I recommend. I don't think the only place I've ever seen them in the last 20 years is in Hawaii. You still see people hitchhiking there. It's just, you know, one of the things that happened was in the 80s, before that, kids couldn't afford cars, really. If you had a friend you went to school with and they had a car, it was like he was like a guy who worked on cars, or he had a job, and you couldn't get a loan. But somewhere in the late 70s and the early 80s, they loosened up credit so that kids could get a car. So it made it a lot less likely that you wouldn't have your own vehicle or access to one.
Growing up, and I grew up kind of in the same era, where it seems that even very young people in elementary school have their own phones, and kids get, you know, their own Mercedes or something coming out of high school. Do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing, or just what it is in your perspective? did we had maybe less and we had to try harder for it. Not saying we, you know, we walked 5 miles in the snow uphill, but what is your perspective on that?
I think that's one of those questions where it's easy to make a sweeping generalization.
Yeah.
And I'm disinclined to do that. So first of all, in Lynn, where I, you know, have spent most of my life, I see all kinds of people who still don't have anything.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I'll come home from a gig and there'll be, you know, there's kids, you know, that they don't have, they're not wearing socks when they're walking to school. They're not, you know, their parent, they don't have a car. So for my friends and their descendants, they all have moved up the food chain, but there's still a whole mess of people who are meal to meal. And so their experience is going to be similar. Whether it's good or not, I don't know. I think that's an individual thing. You know, I'm glad that my children didn't have to struggle the way that we did. You know, that didn't have to, you know, my wife's family, you know, they grew up in the projects and it was tough for them. You know, yeah. Tough at Christmas time, always tough. And so it's better if you don't have to do that. Can you spoil them? You know, can you make them soft? That's possible and it's common and it's not hard to find examples of it. But I would say it doesn't have to be that way. You know, they can grow up okay and still have a good hunger to pursue their own dreams and not feel like everything needs to be given to them.
When you're, you know, out and doing your gigs and selling your books and stuff, do anybody ever come up to you that has lived in maybe a different experience? Maybe they grew up in a wealthy neighborhood or privileged lifestyle and start picking your brain and say, well, what was that all about? Does that ever happen?
Yes, and again, that's another good question, too. You're doing a good job on your end of the thing, like I tell you.
I'm an old guy.
You think how many interviews I've done in my life? Mostly I just kind of live through them.
Yeah.
You know, but that's a really good question. And this is what I would say to young people. This is what I've said to many young people. If you grow up in a tough place and you come out the other side of it strong, right? Like you know, you have a good marriage, you have a good life, you have a good job, you have dignity, you did the difficulties didn't break you, then you need to learn how to write because the rest of the world is fascinated by that. You know, it's a unique story that most people never have access to. So in both of my books, when you read them, if you live in a place that wasn't Lynn, you know, that wasn't, you know, all the things that Lynn is, I mean, it's got good things too, but it's a tough place, right? A lot of murder and heroin and all that business. If you grew up in a better place, it's a nice window into it, and most people who grow up in that environment don't turn out to be writers. They don't mostly go to college. They won't, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. At least in my era, right? So if you can write about it, there's a living in it because the world is, as your question implies, curious about it. Especially if you turn out okay.
Yeah.
You know, if you turn out, it's like a rags to riches thing or it's a beating the odds story, you know, and people are always want to know about it, I think.
Well, because now that you're walking in their world and they wonder how you made that transition because maybe they never experienced that and, you know, they have some curiosity. Before we wrap up here, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
A couple more things before we wrap up. I always ask the guest if there's the question you were never asked that you want to be asked. And what would that be? And you can answer that.
I would have had to think that. You should have just wrote me a letter and told me you were going to ask me that one.
I can always ask you what you never wanted to be asked.
Do I write the music or the lyrics first? I don't want to be written that.
Yeah.
I don't want to be asked that. Again.
Yeah. You can actually, what you can do is give us a little thing that's what's going on with you right now. And is there another book in the works? And you're working on new material or new tours? Or what's going on?
Well, you know, COVID set everything back a little bit. I moved my whole business online. I did live stream shows every Thursday, so I was able to pay my mortgage and all that through the internet, through live streaming concerts. But now I'm back on the road, inching my way back out there. I'm going to Nevada next week to do a storytelling show. And then the Guthrie Center show, if you know anybody, any old hippies that want to make a pilgrimage out to Great Barrington, the 25th of June. It's quite a thing to see that place. If you know Alice's restaurant and the movie, and Arlo is sometimes there, and it's just a very cool thing. And that's a week from Saturday, June 25th. And then, so yeah, I'm staying busy. As far as another, maybe after a while, it's very hard to write a book and have it, and to do it so that it stands up. You know, It's agonizing, and so I need a rest from that now. But eventually maybe I'll write another one. It's something I love to do, but right now I definitely need to step away from that because it's exhausting. It's really hard to do it so that it reads well, that the language flows, that it doesn't drag, that it makes sense, that it's edited well, all of that. It's a big undertaking, so I'm gonna put that on hold for a little while.
Okay, before you go, I want you to cite all your Facebooks and websites, and is there any apologies you have to make to anybody from writing in your book? I imagine not.
No, there's a story in there about my dad, but I had to wait till they were dead for my parents to write that story. That was good to them. When my first book, my dad said, there were a few things in it that he didn't like, which is, I feel a little bad about that. And actually, I toned it down quite a bit. So, I try not to. Try to be kind to everybody. They don't get to write a book to rebut you, so it's you have to be careful with that. So DonWhite.net is the way to find out about gigs and buying books. I still have some CDs left. Like, I made 10 CDs in my life. I'm probably not going to make any more, but I still have, I think, 3 different titles still here. And those are like dirt cheap now, $5 a piece or something. If anybody's interested in that, DonWhite.net. And, you can find me on Facebook and YouTube and all that stuff.
Well, that's great. I have to thank you again, Don, for, being interviewed on the phone here and over your books, and we will keep in touch. And I suggest to our audience, go out, get the book, buy his music, and enjoy. He is from Lynn. What can he say? Don White, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate you.
Okay, have a good one. And we're going to go to music right now.
Great.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, in Medford.
There's a little girl with pretty curls. She's about 5 years old. She is waiting at the gate for her dad to come home. When he pulls round the corner in his shiny white car, she feels the magic light up in her heart. And he picks her up and he holds her. He says he missed her and he's glad that she's here. As the child lays her head on his shoulder, she whispers these words in his ear. Daddy, I know exactly what love is. Love is real simple and true. Love is this feeling my heart gets when I'm being held close by you. Now she is 20 and there's plenty of love everywhere. She's getting married, so her family and her friends are all there. They've gathered this morning to stand at her side as she waves goodbye to this time in her life. And they each take a moment to hold her and to tell her what she means to them. in a world that seems to keep getting colder. She has been blessed with a warm family and friends. She says, I know exactly what love is. Love is real simple and true. Love is this feeling my heart gets when I'm being held close by you. Now they are older and no one told her it got crazy like this. They're going to night school, they're working jobs too, and they are raising three kids. The youngest one is crying with a bruise on her knee. She needs attention and she needs sympathy. And when she picks her up and she holds her, that old magic lights up in her heart. And as the child lays her head on her shoulder, she knows exactly why they're working so hard. Little girl, I know exactly what love is. Love is real simple and true. Love is this feeling my heart gets when I'm being held close by you. Now they are 60 and their history spans 40-odd years. They have buried their parents, now their grandkids are here. There's something about the way they look in each other's eyes that speaks softly about the meaning of life. And when he puts his arm out to hold her, it feels so familiar and warm. She thinks love is an expanding endeavor till your last breath from the moment you're born. She says, I know exactly what love is. Love is real simple and true. Love is this feeling my heart gets when I'm being held close by you. Now she is 80 and she hates being in this nursing home. Her man's been gone now for a long while, and she feels so alone. She closes her eyes as she begins to pray that a little comfort might just come her way. And God lifts her up and he holds her, and she remembers this feeling she has. She is not a woman whose life is almost over. She's a little girl being held by her dad. And God, I know exactly what love is. Love is real simple and true. Love is this feeling my heart gets when I'm being held close by you. God, love is real simple. Love is real simple. And love is real simple and true.
I was born in the city of Lynn, home of the first turbine engine. And as if that wasn't enough, it is also the home of Marshmallow Fluff. Hey, I bet you didn't know that. You can travel the whole country, you'll never find a bigger fluff factory. I'm from Lynn, what can I say? People from Lynn just act this way. I don't talk slick like I'm from Nahant. Oh, what is in the hat, you might ask? Well, it's a little island full of incredibly wealthy people that must have done something evil in some other life because God has cursed them and put them on this little island where they can't go anywhere without driving directly through Lynn. I feel so bad for them. Oh, son of a 30-year GE man, Lord Almighty, what can I say? People from Lynn just act this way. We know three chords. Get used to them. We're not afraid to play them over and 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 over. I used to hang around at Barry Park. That is illegal after it gets dark. I would stand on the bleachers where things got smoked and beer got chug-a-lugged, bottles got broke. Later in the evening when the police come, 27 juveniles are on the run, that's right. Juveniles are running every way you see, jumping over fences, climbing in trees, but you're too loaded to get away. Your name is in the paper on the very next day. Your mother and your father just can't believe you would publicly humiliate the family, yeah. You say, Ma, I'm from Lynn, what can I say? People from Lynn act this way, I don't talk slick, that's what I said. I'm not from Swampscott, Marblehead, Lord Almighty, what can I say? People from Lynn act this way. On the corner of every street, somebody's cooking something greasy to eat. Deep fat is frying everywhere you look. The town is bound for the record books. It's a million sub shops open all night long. A socio-intestinal phenomenon, yeah. Do you want to sing that? That'd be really good. Let's try it. A socio-intestinal phenomenon. It's a socio-intestinal phenomenon. It's a socio-intestinal phenomenon. You people are ridiculous! I'm from Lynn, what can I say? People from Lynn just eat this way. There's no room in my stomach for French cuisine. Give me a bag of cheese curls and a submarine. Julia Child, get out of my face. I'm from Lynn, what can I say? I want a steak bomb. Extra cholesterol. Cook it up, Greasy George. Everybody wants a sub shop in Lynn is always named George. That's funny, isn't it? I don't know if you've ever been to Lynn or Chelsea or Revere or our sister city in the metropolitan region, which you know is Somerville. If you go to any of these cities, any of our sister cities, and you go up to a place that says House of Pizza on the front, inevitably inside you will find four guys in red and white striped shirts who through eons of genetic mutation have been able to maintain a 5 o'clock shadow 24 hours a day. And somehow they're all named George, and I'm not sure exactly why that is. I'm gonna get back to the song now. I lived in 10 years ago. I did not know where I was gonna go. There was 10 people leaning up against the bar and gorilla. It's 10 years later, they're leaning there still. Half of my friends who are not on the street are dead in jail, all Jesus freaks. And they're annoying me. Well, I am from Lynn, what can I say? People from Lynn act this way. I don't talk slick, that's what I said. They won't even let me into Marblehead. They're afraid I'll steal something there. They're probably right. Don't be staring at me that way. I'm from Lynn, what can I say? Thank you.
Pick you up after school. Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit. Make a plan. Be informed. Today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
You're listening to WMFO 91.5 in Medford, WMFO.org. This is Radio Bookmark, and we are getting on to our next guest from Canada, outside Ontario. We have a performer who's been performing many years, originally started with his brother Stan, the late Stan Rogers, and did the song about the Edmund Fitzgerald and been doing many CDs and touring for many years. This is, I believe, his first book. It's on Tickleshore Publishing. And I want to thank you, Garnett Rogers, for coming on. Hi, Garnett.
Hi there.
How you doing today?
Okay. How about you?
I'm hanging in there. You know how age is. There's no future in it. That's my old joke. If you want to talk about your book here, is this your first book?
The novel, you mean?
Yes.
It's my first novel. I wrote a huge, unwieldy, a vaguely fairly vulgar memoir a few years ago.
Okay.
My years on the road with my brother.
Okay. What inspired you to write a novel?
Partly I had to keep. I felt like I was kind of heading towards the abyss about 6 months into the shutdown. My wife and I have a lovely farm here, and you know, there's farm work in the morning, and this sort of lends shape to the day, and horses to take care of, and other animals, and you know, we are really grateful to have the time together. I had sort of backed away from touring about 6 years ago, for the most part, but you know, I needed a project without any shows to do, so I'd had kind of the nub of the idea. Maybe 15 years ago, just two friends who are quite a bit different from each other, but had other things in common, and they get, they're sort of the sort of bystanders in the bombing of a Planned Parenthood building. And, you know, because I travel in the States so much, I'm pretty aware of American politics and the, you know, I just left the room now to, you know, we're watching the hearings. But anyway, you know, it felt like a story that, I wanted to give it a shot anyway, and it kind of blew me in. It took an enormous amount of research, and what I found was really incredibly disturbing about the rise of the far right and its connection to the anti-choice movement. I think you'll probably recall the riots in Charlottesville where young sort of neo-Nazis were, you know, the torches, and they're yelling, "Jews will not replace us." Well, that wasn't just a phrase. That's one of the things they believe, is that white women are not having enough babies, and that eventually the white race will be replaced, and white women need to have more babies. And that's an avowed precept of their movement. And so basically the novel deals with the connection between white power and racism and the anti-choice movement. And it's fairly well documented, and but it was disturbing to find out. I was really busy on Google for about 6 months, just going through old articles and researching things like, how bombs are made, the Timothy McVeigh thing. At any point I was kind of expecting the Canadian federal, security people to turn up at my door saying, "We've been watching your Google history. You're not planning anything stupid, are you?" Because I was, I'm looking up high caliber rifles and really incredibly stupid things like the 50 caliber Barrett sniper rifle and that kind of thing. It's, all of which were sort of written into the story. Most of what I wanted to do is just, I wanted to write a story and focus on personalities and the friendship between a couple of unlikely guys. And it was really fun. I got so into it, and I'm kind of just edging into a sequel now.
Do you identify with any of the characters? Do you see yourself as any of the characters in the book, or you feel you're just an observer and you're writing what's flowing in front of you?
I think, in all honesty, the narrator, Callum Sinclair, he's a Canadian he's got Canadian and U.S. citizenship. His father's a Canadian ambassador, and his mother is sort of a socialite from Virginia, and so he has a foot in both worlds. But he bailed out of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police because of problems with the sort of the endemic racism in there as well, and having been stationed up in northern Alberta and northern Saskatchewan and dealing with the terrible situation with Indigenous peoples up there and how badly they're being treated by our government. So he leaves that, and he becomes an antique dealer, and moves down to Frederick, Maryland. And he becomes very successful at it. He has an eye for the stuff, and that part of it is partly me, the antique stuff. Having been on the road for the last 50 years, I've found myself in tiny little backwater towns, and I've always been picking up little odds and ends and flea markets and stuff. And then what I ended up, you know, with was a huge and unwieldy collection of antique guitars and Navajo rugs and silver and Indian rugs and strange objects from all over North America. So part of that is me. He's a better person than me. He's smarter. He's kinder. He's tougher.
Yeah. Yeah. Excuse me for 1 second. You're listening to WMFO Medford. Thank you. Continue.
Sorry?
Continue, please. I had to do a station ID. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Anyway, he's just a better version of me, I think, on some level. Although he, you know, like I say, he is tougher. And his best friend, he and his best friend, who's a former U.S. Army Ranger who left the service after blowing the whistle on a war crime in Iraq. His friend's Jewish and gay, and so I was kind of hitting all the bases there. And the two of them have this odd relationship based on their disaffection with authority and the fact that they're both fairly liberal in outlook. So there's, you know, that became part of the story as well. And I got to say a lot of things using either one of them as my mouthpiece. I got to say quite a number of things that I believe in. And, you know, it gets turns into a bit of a polemic after, you know, here and there. I tried to avoid that, but it is, in fact, a very political book. It's also humorous. I mean, I try to put as much humor as possible because I do.
Were you afraid? I mean, I read the whole book. That kind of near the end, where the person that was the former ranger basically eliminates some of the people that were doing bad things. How did you kind of reconcile that? It is kind of dark. Did it?
It's very dark.
Yeah.
And Danny wrestles with that part of his personality. Constantly, you know, and I know veterans. I've known veterans.
Yeah.
Back when I first started touring in the United States, I was running into guys from, you know, they'd done their tour in Vietnam, and it's really hard to adjust coming back to real life with, you know, when you're used to just solving things with a trigger. I remember being in a bar in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania one night, and some guy was just rude to the bartender. And the bartender was this big guy, and he had some scars and a kind of a, you know, semi-military haircut. And the guy was just really ignorant to the bartender, and, you know, and he went away, and I said to the bartender, geez, I'm sorry you went through that. And he said, you know, if this was Saigon, that guy would have been dead on the floor. He said, that's what we used to do. You know, he says, I just can't get used to not killing people when I get pissed off at them.
Yeah.
<It's> like, okay.
I see this. I see this book is dedicated to your wife. What is her feeling about this book and you writing it?
I don't know. I don't know what she thinks about anything that I do. Pretty much she worked her way through it.